themselves to women's sexual adjustment and femininity, economists charted a new and revolutionary change in American employment. Beneath the ebb and flow of boom and recession, they found an absolute spiraling decline in employment possibilities for the uneducated and the unskilled. But when the government economists on the Woman Power study visited college campuses, they found the girls unaffected by the statistical probability that they will spend 25 years or more of their adult lives in jobs outside the home. Even when it is virtually certain that most women will no longer spend their lives as full-time housewives, the sex-directed educators have told them not to plan for a career for fear of hampering their sexual adjustment. A few years ago, sex-directed education finally infiltrated a famous women's college, which had been proud in the past of its large share of graduates who went on to play leading roles in education and law and medicine, the arts and sciences, government and social welfare. This college had an ex-feminist woman president who was perhaps beginning to suffer slight guilt at the thought of all those women educated like men. A questionnaire sent to alumni of all ages indicated that the great majority were satisfied with their non-sex-directed education, but a minority complained that their education had made them overly conscious of women's rights and equality with men, too interested in careers, possessed of a nagging feeling that they should do something in the community, that they should at least keep on reading, studying, developing their own abilities and interests. Why hadn't they been educated to be happy housewives and mothers? The guilty woman college president, guilty personally of being a college president, besides having a large number of children and a successful husband, guilty also of having been an ardent feminist in her time and of having advanced a good way in her career before she married, barraged by the therapeutic social scientists who accused her of trying to mold these young girls in her own impossible, unrealistic, outmoded, energetic, self-demanding, visionary, unfeminine image, introduced a functional course in marriage and the family, compulsory for all sophomores. The circumstances which led to the college's decision 2 years later to drop that functional course are shrouded in secrecy. Nobody officially connected with the college will talk. But a neighboring educator, a functionalist crusader himself, said with a certain contempt for naive wrongthinking that they were evidently shocked over there that the girls who took the functional course got married so quickly. The class of 1959 at that college included a record number of 75 wives, nearly a quarter of the girls who still remained in the class. He told me calmly, "Why should it upset them over there that the girls got married a little early? There's nothing wrong with early marriage, with the proper preparation. I guess they can't get over the old notion that women should be educated to develop their minds. They deny it, but one can't help suspecting that they still believe in careers for women. Unfortunately, the idea that women go to college to get a husband is anathema to some educators. At the college in question, marriage and the family is taught once again as a course in sociology, geared to critical analysis of these changing social institutions and not to functional action or group therapy. But in the neighboring institution, my professor informant is second in command of a booming department of family life education, which is currently readying 100 graduate students to teach functional marriage courses in colleges, state teachers' colleges, junior colleges, community colleges, and high schools across America. One senses that these new sex-directed educators do indeed think of themselves as crusaders. Crusaders against the old non-therapeutic, non-functional values of the intellect, against the old, demanding, sexless education, which confined itself to the life of the mind and the pursuit of truth, and never even tried to help girls pursue a man, have orgasms, or adjust. As my informant elaborated, "These kids are concerned about dating and sex. How to get along with boys. Is it all right to have premarital relations? Maybe a girl is trying to decide about her major. She's thinking about a career, and she's also thinking about marriage. You set up a role-playing situation to help her work it out, so she sees the effect on the children. She sees she need not feel guilty about being just a housewife." There often is an air of defensiveness when a sex-directed educator is asked to define For the uninitiated, the functional approach. One told a reporter, "It's all very well to talk big talk, intellectual generalizations, abstract concepts, the United Nations, but somewhere we have to start facing these problems of interpersonal relations on a more modest scale. We have to stop being so teacher-centered and become student-centered. It's not what you think they need, but what they think they need. That's the functional approach. You walk into a class, and your aim is no longer to cover a certain content, but to set up an atmosphere that makes your students feel comfortable and talk freely about interpersonal relations in basic terms, not highfalutin generalizations. Kids tend, in adolescence, to be very idealistic. They think they can acquire a different set of values, marry a boy from a different background, and that it won't matter later on. We make them aware it will matter, so they won't walk so lightly into mixed marriages and other traps." The reporter asked why mate selection, adjustment to marriage, and education for family living are taught in colleges at all if the teacher is committed not to teach, if no material is to be learned or covered, and if the only aim is to help the student understand personal problems and emotions. After surveying a number of marriage courses for Mademoiselle, she concluded, "Only in America would you overhear one undergraduate say to another with total ingenuousness, 'You should have been in class today. We talked about male role-playing, and a couple of people really opened up and got personal.'" The point of role-playing, a technique adapted from group therapy, is to get students to understand problems on a feeling level. Emotions more heady than those of the usual college classroom are undoubtedly stirred up when the professor invites them to role-play the feelings of a boy and a girl on their wedding night. There is a pseudo-therapeutic air as the professor listens patiently to endless self-conscious student speeches about personal feelings, verbalizing, in the hopes of sparking a group insight. But though the functional course is not group therapy, it is certainly an indoctrination of opinions and values through manipulation of the student's emotions. And in this manipulative disguise, it is no longer subject to the critical thinking demanded in other academic disciplines. The students take as gospel the bits and pieces assigned in textbooks that explain Freud or quote Margaret Mead. They do not have the frame of reference that comes from the actual study of psychology or anthropology. In fact, by explicitly banning the usual critical attitudes of college study, these pseudoscientific marriage courses give what is often no more than popular opinion, the fiat of scientific law. The opinion may be currently fashionable or already outdated in psychiatric circles, but it is often merely a prejudice, buttressed by psychological or sociological jargon and well-chosen statistics to give the appearance of unquestionable scientific truth. The discussion on premarital intercourse usually leads to the scientific conclusion that it is wrong. One professor builds up his case against sexual intercourse before marriage with statistics chosen to demonstrate that premarital sexual experience tends to make marital adjustment more difficult. The student will not know of the other statistics which refute this point. If the professor knows of them, he can, in the functional marriage course, feel free to disregard them as unfunctional. Ours is a sick society. The students need some accurate, definitive kind of knowledge. It is functional knowledge that only the exceptional woman can make a go of a commitment to a career. Of course, since most women in the past have not had careers, the few who did were all exceptional. As a mixed marriage is exceptional, and premarital intercourse for a girl is exceptional. All are phenomena of less than 51%. The whole point of functional education often seems to be what 51% of the population does today, 100% should do tomorrow. So the sex-directed educator promotes a girl's adjustment by dissuading her from any but the normal commitment to marriage and the family. One such educator goes farther than imaginary role-playing. She brings real ex-working mothers to class to talk about their guilt at leaving their children in the morning. Somehow the students seldom hear about a woman who has successfully broken convention. The young woman doctor whose sister handled her practice when her babies were born, the mother who adjusted her baby's sleeping hours to her work schedule without problems, the happy Protestant girl who married a Catholic, the sexually serene wife whose premarital experience did not seem to hurt her marriage. Exceptional cases are of no practical concern to the functionalist, though he often acknowledges scrupulously that there are exceptions. The exceptional child, in educational jargon, bears a connotation of handicap. The blind, the crippled, the retarded, the genius, the defier of convention, anyone who is different from the crowd, in any way unique, bears a common shame. He is exceptional. Somehow the student gets the point that she does not want to be the exceptional woman. Conformity is built into life adjustment education in many ways. There is little or no intellectual challenge or discipline involved in merely learning to adjust. The marriage course is the easiest course on almost every campus, no matter how anxiously professors try to toughen it by assigning heavy reading and weekly reports. No one expects that case histories, which when read for no serious use, are not much more than psychiatric soap operas. Role-playing, talking about sex in class, or writing personal papers will lead to critical thinking. That's not the point of functional preparation for marriage. That is not to say that the study of a social science as such produces conformity in woman or man. This is hardly the effect when it is studied critically and motivated by the usual aims of intellectual discipline or when it is mastered for professional use. But for girls forbidden both professional and intellectual commitment by the new mystique, the study of sociology, anthropology, psychology is often merely functional. And in the functional course itself, the girls take those bits and pieces from Freud and Mead, the sexual statistics, the role-playing insights, not only literally and out of context, but personally, to be acted upon in their own lives. That, after all, is the whole point of life adjustment education. It can happen among adolescents in almost any course that involves basic emotional material. It will certainly happen when the material is deliberately used not to build critical knowledge, but to stir up personal emotions. Therapy, in the orthodox psychoanalytic tradition, requires the suppression of critical thinking, intellectual resistance, for the proper emotions to come out and be worked through. In therapy, this may work. But does education work mixed up with therapy? One course could hardly be crucial in any man or woman's life, but when it is decided that the very aim of woman's education should not be intellectual growth, but sexual adjustment, certain questions could be very crucial. One might ask, if an education geared to the growth of the human mind weakens femininity, will an education geared to femininity weaken the growth of the mind? What is femininity if it can be destroyed by an education which makes the mind grow, or induced by not letting the mind grow? One might even ask a question in Freudian terms. What happens when sex becomes not only id for women, but ego and superego as well? When education, instead of developing the self, is concentrated on developing the sexual functions? What happens when education gives new authority to the feminine shoulds, which already have the authority of tradition, convention, prejudice, popular opinion, instead of giving women the power of critical thought, the independence and autonomy to question blind authority, new or old? At Pembroke, the Women's College at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, a guest psychoanalyst was recently invited to lead a buzz session on what it means to be a woman. The students seemed disconcerted when the guest analyst, Dr. Margaret Lawrence, said in simple, un-Freudian English, that it was rather silly to tell women today that their main place is in the home, when most of the work women used to do is now done outside the home, and everyone else in the family spends most of his time outside the house. Hadn't they better be educated to join the rest of the family, out there in the world? This somehow was not what the girls expected to hear from a lady psychoanalyst. Unlike the usual functional sex-directed lesson, it upset a conventional feminine should. It also implied that they should begin to make certain decisions of their own about their education and their future. The functional lesson is much more soothing to the unsure sophomore who has not yet quite made the break from childhood. It does not defy the comfortable, safe conventions. It gives her sophisticated words for accepting her parents' view, the popular view, without having to figure out views of her own. It also reassures her that she doesn't have to work in college, that she can be lazy, follow impulse. She doesn't have to postpone present pleasure for future goals. She doesn't have to read 8 books for a history paper, take the tough physics course. It might give her a masculinity complex. After all, didn't the book say, woman's intellectuality is to a large extent paid for by the loss of valuable feminine qualities. All observations point to the fact that the intellectual woman is masculinized, and her warm, intuitive knowledge has yielded to cold, unproductive thinking. A girl doesn't have to be very lazy, very unsure, to take the hint. Thinking, after all, is hard work. In fact, she would have to do some very cold, hard thinking about her own warm, intuitive knowledge to challenge this authoritative statement. It is no wonder that several generations of American college girls of fine mind and fiery spirit took the message of the sex-directed educators and fled college and career to marry and have babies before they became so intellectual that, heaven forbid, they wouldn't be able to enjoy sex in a feminine way. Even without the help of sex-directed educators, the girl growing up with brains and spirit in America learned soon enough to watch her step, to be like all the others, not to be herself. She learns not to work too hard, think too often, ask too many questions. In high schools, in coeducational colleges, girls are reluctant to speak out in class for fear of being typed as brains. This phenomenon has been born out of many studies. Any bright girl or woman can document it from personal experience. Bryn Mawr girls have a special term for the way they talk when boys are around, compared to the real talk they can permit themselves when they are not afraid to let their intelligence show. In the coeducational colleges, girls are regarded by others and think of themselves primarily in terms of their sexual function as dates, future wives. They seek my security in him instead of finding themselves, and each act of self-betrayal tips the scale further away from identity to passive self-contempt. There are exceptions, of course. The Mellon study found that some Vassar seniors, as compared with freshmen, showed enormous growth in 4 years, the kind of growth toward identity and self-realization which scientists now know takes place in people in their 20s and even 30s, 40s, and 50s, long after the period of physical growth is over. But many girls showed no signs of growth. These were the ones who resisted, successfully, involvement with ideas, the academic work of the college, the intellectual disciplines, the larger values. They resisted intellectual development, self-development, in favor of being feminine. Not too brainy, not too interested, not too different from the other girls. It was not that their actual sexual interests interfered. In fact, the psychologist got the impression that with many of these girls, interest in men in marriage is a kind of defense against intellectual development. For such girls, even sex is not real, merely a kind of conformity. The sex-directed educator would find no fault in this kind of adjustment. But in view of other evidence, one might ask, could such an adjustment mask a failure to grow that becomes finally a human deformity? Several years ago, a team of California psychologists who had been following the development of 140 bright youngsters noticed a sudden sharp drop in IQ curves in some of the teenage records. When they investigated this, they found that while most of the youngsters' curves remained at the same high level year after year, those whose curves dropped were all girls. The drop had nothing to do with the physiological changes of adolescence. It was not found in all girls. But in the records of those girls whose intelligence dropped were found repeated statements to the effect that it isn't too smart for a girl to be smart. In a very real sense, these girls were arrested in their mental growth at age 14 or 15 by conformity to the feminine image. The fact is, girls today and those responsible for their education do face a choice. They must decide between adjustment, conformity, avoidance of conflict, therapy, or individuality, human identity, education in the truest sense, with all its pains of growth. But they do not have to face the mistaken choice painted by the sex-directed educators with their dire warnings against loss of femininity and sexual frustration. For the perceptive psychologists who studied the Vassar girls uncovered some startling new evidence about the students who chose to become truly involved with their education. It seems that those seniors who showed the greatest signs of growth were more masculine in the sense of being less passive and conventional, but they were more feminine in inner emotional life and the ability to gratify it. They also scored higher, far higher than as freshmen, on certain scales commonly supposed to measure neuroses. The psychologist commented, "We have come to regard elevations on such scales as evidence that education is taking place." He found girls with conflicts showed more growth than the adjusted ones who had no wish to become independent. The least adjusted were also the more developed, already prepared for even further changes and more independence. In summing up the Vassar study, its director could not avoid the psychological paradox. Education for women does make them less feminine, less adjusted, but it makes them grow. Being less feminine is closely related to being more educated and more mature. It is interesting to note, however, that feminine sensitivity, which may well have sources in physiology and in early identifications, does not decrease during the 4 years. Feminine interests and feminine role behavior, that is, conventionality and passivity, can be understood as later and more superficial acquisitions, and hence more susceptible to decrease as the individual becomes more mature and more educated. One might say that if we were interested in stability alone, we would do well to plan a program to keep freshmen as they are, rather than to try to increase their education, their maturity, and their flexibility with regard to sex role behavior. Seniors are more unstable because there is more to be stabilized, less certain of their identities because more possibilities are open to them. At graduation, such women were, however, only at a halfway point in their growth to autonomy. Their fate depended on whether they now enter a situation in which they can continue to grow, or whether they find some quick but regressive means for relieving the stress. The flight into marriage is the easiest, quickest way to relieve that stress. To the educator, bent on women's growth to autonomy, such a marriage is regressive. To the sex-directed educator, it is femininity fulfilled. A therapist at another college told me of girls who had never committed themselves either to their work or any other activity of the college, and who felt that they would go to pieces when their parents refused to let them leave college to marry the boys in whom they found security. When these girls, with help, finally applied themselves to work, or even began to feel a sense of self by taking part in an activity such as student government or the school newspaper, they lost their desperate need for security. They finished college, worked, went out with more mature young men, and are now marrying on quite a different emotional basis. Unlike the sex-directed educator, this professional therapist felt that the girl who suffers almost to the point of breakdown in the senior year and who faces a personal decision about her own future faces even an irreconcilable conflict between the values and interests and abilities her education has given her and the conventional role of housewife is still healthier than the adjusted, calm, stable girl in whom education did not take at all, and who steps smoothly from her role as parent's child to husband's wife, conventionally feminine, without ever waking up to painful individual identity. And yet the fact is, today, most girls do not let their education take. They stop themselves before getting this close to identity. I could see this in the girls at Smith and the girls I interviewed from other colleges. It was clear in the Vassar research. The Vassar study showed that just as girls begin to feel the conflicts, the growing pains of identity, they stop growing. They more or less consciously stop their own growth to play the feminine role. Or, to put it in another way, they evade further experiences conducive to growth. Until now, this stunting or evasion of growth has been considered normal feminine adjustment. But when the Vassar study followed women past the senior year, where they were on the verge of this painful, crucial step in personal growth, out into life, where most of them were playing the conventional feminine role, these facts emerged. Number one. 20 or 25 years out of college, these women measured lower than seniors on the development scale, which covered the whole gamut of mental, emotional, and personal growth. They did not lose all the growth achieved in college. Alumni scored higher than freshmen, but in spite of the psychological readiness for further growth at 21, they did not keep growing. Number two. These women were, for the most part, adjusted as suburban housewives, conscientious mothers, active in their communities. But, except for the professional career women, they had not continued to pursue deep interests of their own. There seemed some reason to believe that the cessation of growth was related to the lack of deep personal interests, the lack of an individual commitment. Number three. The women who, 20 years later, were most troubling to the psychologist were the most conventionally feminine, the ones who were not interested, even in college, in anything except finding a husband. In the Vassar study, there was one group of students who in senior year neither suffered conflict to the point of near breakdown nor stopped their own growth to flee into marriage. These were students who were preparing for a profession. They had gained, in college, interests deep enough to commit themselves to a career. The study revealed that virtually all such students with professional ambitions plan to marry, but marriage is for them an activity in which they will voluntarily choose to participate rather than something that is necessary for any sense of personal identity. Such students have a clear sense of direction, a greater degree of independence and self-confidence than most. They may be engaged or deeply in love, but they do not feel they must sacrifice their own individualities or their career ambitions if they wish to marry. With these girls, the psychologists did not get the impression, as they did with so many, that interest in men and in marriage was a kind of defense against intellectual development. Their interest in some particular man was real. At the same time, it did not interfere with their education. But the degree to which the feminine mystique has brainwashed American educators was shown when the director of the Vassar study described to a panel of his colleagues such a girl who not only makes top grades, but in whose case there is high probability that a scholarly or professional career will be followed. Julie B.'s mother is a teacher and scholar and the driving force in the family. Mother gets after father for being too easygoing. Father doesn't mind if his wife and daughter have highbrow tastes and ideas, only such are not for him. Julie becomes outdoor girl, nonconformist, dominates her older brother, but is conscience-stricken if she doesn't do required reading or if her grade average slips, sticks to her intention to do graduate work and become teacher. Older brother now college teacher, and Julie, herself a graduate student now, is married to a graduate student in natural science. When she was a freshman, we presented her interview data, without interpretation, to a group of psychiatrists, psychologists, social scientists. Our idea of a really promising girl. Common question. What's wrong with her? Common opinion. She would need psychotherapy. Actually, she got engaged to her budding scientist in her sophomore year, became increasingly conscious of herself as an intellectual and outsider, but still couldn't neglect her work. If only I could flunk something, she said. It takes a very daring educator today to attack the sex-directed line, for he must challenge, in essence, the conventional image of femininity. The image says that women are passive, dependent, conformist, incapable of critical thought or original contribution to society. And in the best traditions of the self-fulfilling prophecy, sex-directed education continues to make them so, as in an earlier era, lack of education made them so. No one asks whether a passively feminine, uncomplicated, dependent woman in a primitive village or in a suburb actually enjoys greater happiness, greater sexual fulfillment than a woman who commits herself in college to serious interests beyond the home. No one, until very recently, when Russians orbited moons and men in space, asked whether adjustment should be education's aim. In fact, the sex-directed educators, so bent on women's feminine adjustment, could gaily cite the most ominous facts about American housewives: their emptiness, idleness, boredom, alcoholism, drug addiction, disintegration to fat, disease, and despair after 40, when their sexual function has been filled, without deviating a bit from their crusade to educate all women to this sole end. so the sex-directed educator disposes of the 30 years women are likely to live after 40 with three blithe proposals. Number one, a course in Law and Order for the Housewife to enable her to deal as a widow with insurances, taxes, wills, investments. Number two, men might retire earlier to help keep their wives company. Number three, a brief fling in volunteer community services, politics, the arts, or the like. Though, since the woman will be untrained, the main value will be personal therapy. To choose only one example, a woman who wants some really novel experience may start a campaign to rid her city or country of that nauseous eczema of our modern world, the billboard. The billboards will remain and multiply like bacteria infesting the landscape, but at least she will have had a vigorous adult education course in local politics. Then she can relax and devote herself to the alumni activities of the institution from which she graduated. Many a woman approaching middle years has found new vigor and enthusiasm in identifying herself with the ongoing life of her college and in expanding her maternal instincts now that her own children are grown to encompass the new generations of students which inhabit its campus. She could also take a part-time job, he said, but she shouldn't take work away from men who must feed their families, and in fact, she won't have the skills or experience for a very exciting job. There is a great demand for experienced and reliable women who can relieve younger women of family responsibilities on regular days or afternoons so that they may either develop community interests or hold part-time jobs of their own. There is no reason why women of culture and breeding, who in any case for years have probably done most of their own housework, should recoil from such arrangements. If the feminine mystique has not destroyed her sense of humor, a woman might laugh at such a candid description of the life her expensive, sex-directed education fits her for. An occasional alumni reunion and someone else's housework. The sad fact is, in the era of Freud and functionalism and the feminine mystique, few educators escaped such a sex distortion of their own values. Max Lerner, even Reisman in The Lonely Crowd, suggested that women need not seek their own autonomy through productive contribution to society. They might better help their husbands hold on to theirs through play. And so sex-directed education segregated recent generations of able American women as surely as separate but equal education segregated able American Negroes from the opportunity to realize their full abilities in the mainstream of American life. It does not explain anything to say that in this era of conformity, colleges did not really educate anybody. The Jacob Report, which leveled this indictment against American colleges generally, and even the more sophisticated indictment by Sanford and his group, does not recognize that the college's failure to educate women for an identity beyond their sexual role was undoubtedly a crucial factor in perpetuating, if not creating, that conformity which educators now so fashionably rail against. For it is impossible to educate women to devote themselves so early and completely to their sexual role, women who, as Freud said, can be very active indeed in achieving a passive end without pulling men into the same comfortable trap. In effect, sex-directed education led to a lack of identity in women most easily solved by early marriage. And a premature commitment to any role, marriage, or vocation closes off the experiences, the testing, the failures and successes, and various spheres of activity that are necessary for a person to achieve full maturity, individual identity. The danger of stunting of boys' growth by early domesticity was recognized by the sex-directed educators. As Margaret Mead put it recently, early domesticity has always been characteristic of most savages, of most peasants, and of the urban poor. If there are babies, it means, you know, the father's term paper gets all mixed up with the baby's bottle. Early student marriage is domesticating boys so early they don't have a chance for full intellectual development. They don't have a chance to give their entire time, not necessarily to study, in the sense of staying in the library, but in the sense that the married students don't have time to experience, to think, to sit up all night in bull sessions, to develop as individuals. This is not only important for the intellectuals, but also the boys who are going to be the future statesmen of the country, and lawyers and doctors, and all sorts of professional men. But what of the girls who will never even write the term papers because of the baby's bottle? Because of the feminine mystique, few have seen it as a tragedy that they thereby trap themselves in that one passion, one occupation, one role for life. Advanced educators in the early 1960s have their own cheerful fantasies about postponing women's education until after they have had their babies. They thereby acknowledge that they have resigned themselves almost unanimously to the early marriages, which continue unabated. But by choosing femininity over the painful growth to full identity, by never achieving the hard core of self that comes not from fantasy, but from mastering reality, these girls are doomed to suffer, ultimately, that bored, diffuse feeling of purposelessness, non-existence, non-involvement with the world that can be called anomie, or lack of identity, or merely felt as the problem that has no name. Still, it is too easy to make education the scapegoat. Whatever the mistakes of the sex-directed educators, other educators have fought a futile, frustrating rearguard battle, trying to make able women envision new goals and grow by reaching for them. In the last analysis, millions of able women in this free land chose, themselves, not to use the door education could have opened for them. The choice and the responsibility for the race back home was finally their own. Chapter 8, The Mistaken Choice. A mystique does not compel its own acceptance. For the feminine mystique to have brainwashed American women of non-sexual human purposes for more than 15 years, it must have filled real needs in those who seized on it for others, and those who accepted it for themselves. Those needs may not have been the same in all the women or in all the purveyors of the mystique. But there were many needs at this particular time in America that made us pushovers for the mystique. Needs so compelling that we suspended critical thought, as one does in the face of an intuitive truth. The trouble is, when need is strong enough, intuition can also lie. There was, just before the feminine mystique took hold in America, a war which followed a depression and ended with the explosion of an atom bomb. After the loneliness of war and the unspeakableness of the bomb, against the frightening uncertainty, the cold immensity of the changing world, women, as well as men, sought the comforting reality of home and children. In the foxholes, the GIs had pinned up pictures of Betty Grable, but the songs they asked to hear were lullabies. And when they got out of the army, they were too old to go home to their mothers. The needs of sex and love are undeniably real in men and women, boys and girls, but why at this time did they seem to so many the only needs? We were all vulnerable, homesick, lonely, frightened. A pent-up hunger for marriage, home, and children was felt simultaneously by several different generations, a hunger which, in the prosperity of post-war America, everyone could suddenly satisfy. The young GI, made older than his years by the war, could meet his lonely need for love and mother by recreating his childhood home. Instead of dating many girls until college and profession were achieved, he could marry on the GI Bill and give his own babies the tender mother love he was no longer baby enough to seek for himself. Then there were the slightly older men of 25, whose marriages had been postponed by the war and who now felt they must make up for lost time. Men in their 30s, kept first by depression and then by war from marrying, or if married, from enjoying the comforts of home. For the girls, these lonely years added an extra urgency to their search for love. Those who married in the 30s saw their husbands off to war. Those who grew up in the 40s were afraid, with reason, that they might never have the love, the homes, and children, which few women would willingly miss. When the men came back, there was a headlong rush into marriage. The lonely years when husbands or husbands-to-be were away at war, or could be sent away at a bomb's fall, made women particularly vulnerable to the feminine mystique. They were told that the cold dimension of loneliness, which the war had added to their lives, was the necessary price they had to pay for a career, for any interest outside the home. The mystique spelled out a choice: love, home, children, or other goals and purposes in life. Given such a choice, was it any wonder that so many American women chose love as their whole purpose? The baby boom of the immediate post-war years took place in every country, but it was not permeated in most other countries with the mystique of feminine fulfillment. It did not, in other countries, lead to the even greater baby boom of the 50s, with the rise in teenage marriages and pregnancies and the increase in family size. The number of American women with three or more children doubled in 20 years, and educated women after the war led all the others in the race to have more babies. The generation before mine, the women born between 1910 and 1919, showed the change most sharply. During their 20s, their low pregnancy rate led to warnings that education was going to wipe out the human race. In their 30s, they suddenly showed a sharp increase in pregnancies, despite the lowered biological capacity that makes the pregnancy rate decline with age. More babies are always born after wars. But today, the American population explosion comes in large part from teenage marriages. The number of children born to teenagers rose 165% between 1940 and 1957, according to the Metropolitan Life Insurance figures. The girls who would normally go to college but leave or forgo it to marry, 18 and 19 are most frequent ages of marriage of American girls today, half of all American women are married by 20, are products of the mystique. They give up education without a qualm, truly believing that they will find fulfillment as wives and mothers. I suppose a girl today who knows from statistics or merely from observation that if she waits to marry until she finishes college or trains for a profession, most of the men will be married to someone else, has as much reason to fear she may miss feminine fulfillment as the war gave the girls in the 40s. But this does not explain why they drop out of college to support their husbands while the boys continue with their education. It has not happened in other countries. Even in countries where, during the war, many more men were killed and more women were forced forever to miss the fulfillment of marriage, women did not run home again in panic. And in the other countries today, girls are as hungry as boys for the education that is the road to the future. War made women particularly vulnerable to the mystique, but the war, with all its frustrations, was not the only reason they went home again. Nor can it be explained by the servant problem, which is an excuse the educated woman often gives to herself. During the war, when the cooks and maids went to work in the war plants, the servant problem was even more severe than in recent years. But at that time, women of spirit often worked out unconventional domestic arrangements to keep their professional commitments. I knew two young wartime mothers who pooled forces while their husbands were overseas. One, an actress, took both babies in the morning, while the other did graduate work. The second took over in the afternoon when the other had a rehearsal or matinee. I also knew a woman who switched her babies night and day, so he would sleep at a neighbor's house during the hours she was at medical school. And in the cities, then, the need for nurseries and daycare centers for the children of working mothers was seen and met. But in the years of post-war femininity, even women who could afford and find a full-time nurse or housekeeper chose to take care of house and children themselves. And in the cities, during the 50s, the nursery and daycare centers for the children of working mothers all but disappeared. The very suggestion of their need brought hysterical outcries from educated housewives as well as the purveyors of the mystique. When the war ended, of course, GIs came back to take the jobs and fill the seats in colleges and universities that for a while had been occupied largely by girls. For a short time, competition was keen, and the resurgence of the old anti-feminine prejudices in business and the professions made it difficult for a girl to keep or advance in a job. This undoubtedly sent many women scurrying for the cover of Marriage and Home. Subtle discrimination against women, to say nothing of the sex wage differential, is still an unwritten law today, and its effects are almost as devastating and as hard to fight as the flagrant opposition faced by the feminists. A woman researcher on Time magazine, for instance, cannot, no matter what her ability, aspire to be a writer. The unwritten law makes the men writers and editors, the women researchers. She doesn't get mad. She likes her job. She likes her boss. She's not a crusader for women's rights. It isn't a case for the Newspaper Guild, but it is discouraging, nevertheless. If she is never going to get anywhere, why keep on? Women were often driven embittered from their chosen fields when, ready and able to handle a better job, they were passed over for a man. In some jobs, a woman had to be content to do the work while the man got the credit, or if she got the better job, she had to face the bitterness and hostility of the man. Because the race to get ahead in the big organization, in every profession in America, is so terribly competitive for men, competition from women is somehow the last straw, and much easier to fight by simply evoking that unwritten law. During the war, women's abilities and the inevitable competition were welcome. After the war, they were confronted with that polite but impenetrable curtain of hostility. It was easier for a woman to love and be loved and have an excuse not to compete with men. Still, during the Depression, able-spirited girls sacrificed, fought prejudice, and braved competition in order to pursue their careers, even though there were fewer places to compete for. Nor did many see any conflict between career and love. In the prosperous post-war years, there were plenty of jobs, plenty of places in all the professions. There was no real need to give up everything for love and marriage. The less educated girls, after all, did not leave the factories and go back to being maids. The proportion of women in industry has steadily increased since the war, but not of women in careers or professions requiring training, effort, personal commitment. I lived through my husband and children, a frank member of my own generation told me. It's easier that way. In this world now, it's easier to be a woman if you take advantage of it. In this sense, what happened to women is part of what happened to all of us in the years after the war. We found excuses for not facing the problems we once had the courage to face. The American spirit fell into a strange sleep. Men as well as women, scared liberals, disillusioned radicals, conservatives bewildered and frustrated by change, the whole nation stopped growing up. All of us went back into the warm brightness of home, the way it was when we were children, and slept peacefully upstairs while our parents read or played bridge in the living room or rocked on the front porch in the summer evening in our hometowns. Women went home again, just as men shrugged off the bomb, forgot the concentration camps, condoned corruption, and fell into helpless conformity. Just as the thinkers avoided the complex, larger problems of the post-war world. It was easier, safer, to think about love and sex than about communism, McCarthy, and the uncontrolled bomb. It was easier to look for Freudian sexual roots in man's behavior, his ideas, and his wars, than to look critically at his society and act constructively to right its wrongs. There was a kind of personal retreat, even on the part of the most far-sighted, the most spirited. We lowered our eyes from the horizon and steadily contemplated our own navels. We can see all this now in retrospect. Then it was easier to build the need for love and sex into the end-all purpose of life, avoiding personal commitment to truth in a catch-all commitment to home and family. For the social worker, the psychologist, and the numerous family counselors, analytically oriented therapy for private patients on personal problems of sex, personality, and interpersonal relations was safer and more lucrative than probing too deeply for the common causes of man's suffering. If you no longer wanted to think about the whole of mankind, at least you could help individuals without getting into trouble. Erwin Shaw, who once goaded the American conscience on the great issues of war and peace and racial prejudice, now wrote about sex and adultery. Norman Mailer and the young beatnik writers confined their revolutionary spirit to sex and kicks and drugs and advertising themselves in four-letter words. It was easier and more fashionable for writers to think about psychology than politics, about private motives than public purposes. Painters retreated into an abstract expressionism that flaunted discipline and glorified the evasion of meaning. Dramatists reduced human purpose to bitter, pretentious nonsense, the theater of the absurd. Freudian thought gave this whole process of escape its dimension of endless, tantalizing intellectual mystery, process within process, meaning hidden within meaning, until meaning itself disappeared and the hopeless, dull outside world hardly existed at all. As a drama critic said in a rare note of revulsion at the stage world of Tennessee Williams, it was as if no reality remained for man except his sexual perversions and the fact that he loved and hated his mother. The Freudian mania in American culture, apart from the practice of psychotherapy itself, also filled a real need in the 40s and 50s. The need for an ideology, a national purpose, an application of the mind to the problems of people. Analysts themselves have recently suggested that the lack of an ideology or national purpose may be partially responsible for the personal emptiness which sends many men and women into psychotherapy. They are actually looking for an identity which therapy alone can never give. The religious revival in America coincided with the rush to psychoanalysis and perhaps came about for the same reason, behind the search for identity or for shelter, a vacuum of larger purpose. It is significant that many ministers now spend much of their time in giving psychotherapy, pastoral counseling, to members of their congregations. Do they thereby also evade the larger questions, the real search? When I was interviewing on college campuses in the late 50s, chaplains and sociologists alike testified to the younger generation's privatism. A major reason for the early marriage movement, they felt, was that the young saw no other true value in contemporary society. It's easy for the professional social critic to blame the younger generation for cynical preoccupation with private pleasure and material security, or for the empty negativism of beatnikery. But if their parents, teachers, preachers have abdicated purposes larger than personal, emotional adjustment, material success, security, what larger purpose can the young learn? The five babies, the movement to suburbia, do-it-yourself, and even beatnikery, filled homely needs. They also took the place of those larger needs and purposes with which the most spirited in this nation were once concerned. I'm bored with politics. There's nothing you can do about it anyhow. When a dollar was too cheap and too expensive to live a life for, and your whole society seemed concerned with little else, the family and its loves and problems, this, at least, was good and true. And the literal swallowing of Freud gave the illusion that it was more important than it really was for the whole of suffering society, as a literal parroting of Freudian phrases deluded suffering individuals into believing that they were cured, when underneath they had not yet even faced their real troubles. Under the Freudian microscope, however, a very different concept of family began to emerge. Oedipus conflict and sibling rivalry became household words. Frustration was as great a peril to childhood as scarlet fever, and singled out for special attention was the mother. It was suddenly discovered that the mother could be blamed for almost everything. In every case, history of troubled child, alcoholic, suicidal, schizophrenic, psychopathic, neurotic adult, impotent, homosexual male, frigid, promiscuous female, ulcerous, asthmatic, and otherwise disturbed American could be found a mother. A frustrated, repressed, disturbed, martyred, never satisfied, unhappy woman. A demanding, nagging, shrewish wife. A rejecting, overprotecting, dominating mother. World War II revealed that millions of American men were psychologically incapable of facing the shock of war, of facing life away from their moms. Clearly, something was wrong with American women. By unfortunate coincidence, this attack against mothers came about at the same time that American women were beginning to use the rights of their emancipation to go in increasing numbers to college and professional schools, to rise in industry and the professions in inevitable competition with men. Women were just beginning to play a part in American society that depended not on their sex, but on their individual abilities. It was apparent to the naked eye, obvious to the returning GI, that these American women were indeed more independent, strong-minded, assertive of will and opinion, less passive and feminine than, for instance, the German and Japanese girls who the GIs boasted even washed our backs for us. It was less apparent, however, that these girls were different from their mothers. Perhaps that is why, By some strange distortion of logic, all the neuroses of children past and present were blamed on the independence and individuality of this new generation of American girls. Independence and individuality which the housewife mothers of the previous generation had never had. The evidence seemed inescapable. The figures on the psychiatric discharges in the war and the mothers in their case histories. The early Kinsey figures on the incapacity of American women to enjoy sexual orgasm, especially educated women. The fact that so many women were frustrated and took it out on their husbands and children. More and more men in America did feel inadequate, impotent. Many of those first generations of career women did miss love and children, resented and were resented by the men they competed with. More and more American men, women, children were going to mental hospitals, clinics, psychiatrists. All this was laid at the doorstep of the frustrated American mother, masculinized by her education, prevented by her insistence on equality and independence from finding sexual fulfillment as a woman. It all fitted so neatly with the Freudian rationale that no one stopped to investigate what these pre-war mothers were really like. They were indeed frustrated, but the mothers of the maladjusted soldiers, the insecure and impotent post-war males, were not independent, educated career women, but self-sacrificing, dependent, martyred housewife moms. In 1940, less than a fourth of American women worked outside the home. Those who did were for the most part unmarried. A minuscule 2.5% of mothers were career women. The mothers of the GIs who were 18 to 30 in 1940 were born in the 19th century or the early 1900s and were grown up before American women won the right to vote or enjoyed the independence, the sexual freedom, the educational, or the career opportunities of the 20s. By and large, these moms were neither feminists nor products of feminism, but American women leading the traditional feminine life of housewife and mother. Was it really education, career dreams, independence, which made the moms frustrated and take it out on their children? Even a book that helped build the new mystique, Edward Strecker's Their Mother's Sons, confirms the fact that the moms were neither career women nor feminists, nor used their education if they had it. They lived for their children. They had no interests beyond home, children, family, or their own beauty. In fact, they fit the very image of the feminine mystique. Here is the mom whom Dr. Strecker, as consultant to the Surgeon General of the Army and Navy, found guilty in the case histories of the vast majority of the 1,825,000 men rejected for military service because of psychiatric disorders. The 600,000 discharged from the Army for neuropsychiatric reasons, and the 500,000 more who tried to evade the draft, almost 3 million men out of 15 million in the service who retreated into psychoneuroses, often only a few days after induction because they lacked maturity, the ability to face life, live with others, think for themselves, and stand on their own two feet. A mom is a woman whose maternal behavior is motivated by the seeking of emotional recompense for the buffets which life has dealt her own ego. In her relationship with her children, every deed and almost every breath are designed unconsciously but exclusively to absorb her children emotionally and to bind them to her securely. In order to achieve this purpose, she must stamp a pattern of immature behavior on her children. The mothers of men and women capable of facing life maturely are not apt to be the traditional mom type. More likely, mom is sweet, doting, self-sacrificing, takes no end of trouble, and spares herself no pains in selecting clothes for her grown-up children. She supervises the curl of their hair, the selection of their friends and companions, their sports, and their social attitudes and opinions. By and large, she does all their thinking for them. This domination is sometimes hard and arbitrary, more often soft, persuasive, and somewhat devious. Most frequent is the method of indirection in which in some way the child is made to feel that mom's hurt and trying ever so hard to conceal that hurt. The soft method is infinitely more successful in blocking manifestations of youthful thought and action. The self-sacrificing mom, when hard-pressed, may admit hesitantly that perhaps she does look played out and is actually a bit tired, but she chirps brightly, "What of it?" The implication is that she does not care how she looks or feels, for in her heart, there is the unselfish joy of service. From dawn until late at night, she finds her happiness in doing for her children. The house belongs to them. It must be just so. The meals on the minute, hot and tempting. Food is available at all hours. No buttons missing from garments in this orderly house. Everything is in its proper place.